during the summer, we have a lot of producers turning to baleage, which is the product that will have over 60% of moisture to bale. And also for the cool season annuals as well, because then you can conserve that forage that's really, really high quality for a time later during summer, for example, that you would be able to just rely on adding that to the lower quality material that may be available for grazing, for example.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Boost digestive health, performance, and profitability with Digesterone Prime, a feed additive that enhances digestion and immune function in dairy calves. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/prime. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Agrarian Solutions, research-backed microbial solutions for healthier, higher-performing livestock. AgriComfort, the cow comfort specialist, because her longevity is your legacy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dairy Podcast Show brought to you by Wyzenetics. I'm Dr. Liz Eckelkamp, a new host and an associate professor and dairy extension specialist at the University of Tennessee. I'm joined today by Dr. Liliani Silva, a forage specialist at Clemson University. Liliani earned her PhD from University of Florida in 2019 after receiving her bachelor's and master's from the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. In 2021, she joined Clemson University at the Adisto Research and Education Center after finishing her postdoc at Auburn with some of my friends that I work with here at University of Tennessee. Her research focuses on developing improved management practices to enhance production, sustainability, profitability, and resilience of forage livestock systems. She is currently working with grazing summer and winter cover crops, measuring greenhouse gases from livestock systems, determining soil carbon and nitrogen accumulation, in addition to other interdisciplinary efforts across a variety of different southern states. So welcome, Liliani. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's my pleasure to be here.
So we were talking a little bit before the podcast and realized that the dairy world, again, is incredibly small. Liliani and I have like 3 points of connection, at least. In our little southern section.
We joke how the forages world is small. And like last year, I was able to go to the dairy association meeting. And I was like, first I thought I would not know anybody that was there. And I was walking the hallways and I was like, hi. And I was like, oh, I should be coming here more often. I know people here as well.
My people.
Yeah.
Something we didn't talk about before. I'm actually married to a gator.
Really? Ah, that's nice.
I am married to a gator engineer. So when I saw your phone number address, I was like, I know where that zip code is from.
First, you think that I am a spam because the 3 have 2, like sometimes supposed to say it with like some of the spam things. And I was like, oh, no, I just got when I was there.
I still have my Louisiana phone number. And anytime I get one of those from Tennessee, I'm like, you're not real. You don't actually need to talk to me. So your program is heavily focused on the integration of forage and livestock systems. So through that lens, what do you see as the role of forages in the dairy industry?
So we, forages for us, especially in the Southeast, it is the basis of the most of the systems that we end up having. And with the increasing costs of feed, it's definitely one of those alternatives that we can produce a high gray matter with lower costs associated. Nowadays, it's becoming more and more challenging to do that because of the prices of fuel and fertilizer. But it still is something that will end up being just more economical for operations. And we do need to be looking at that because producers are always working with such a lower margin of profit that they need to be taking care of the budget on their end as well. And for the animals, we definitely need to be balancing those ratio for them to get what they need. And we have such a variety of forages, like we can definitely be working to balance quality, production, environmental benefits as well that we're going to talk later. So forage is definitely like has a really, really important role in the industry.
Especially thinking like looking back at USDA data, if you index our cost of production, even though the Southeast, we enjoy that higher milk price, right? Without fail, our feed costs are the highest across the country, which has always puzzled me since we do have such a moderate climate and a potentially long growing season or grazing season, depending on which area you're in. So why do you think that continues to be a struggle for our dairy farmers in the Southeast, having that consistently higher homegrown and purchased feed cost?
Especially after coming here in South Carolina, we used to have a larger dairy industry here. And when I first came in, I talked with a lot of producers through the extension events, et cetera, that I was doing. And a lot of people went out of the industry probably around the 50s and forward. There are still some people, but very, very small, a number of producers. One of the points that they mention a lot is that, and I'm going to speak more here because that's the reality here. We have been having a lot of urban growth. So prices of land just skyrocketed, and there's so much developing areas, developers coming in that it's really hard sometimes to compete with prices that people are getting for the land. And a lot of producers, not just for dairy, but sometimes for the cow and hay, the pasture and hay production as well, they are actually renting land from somebody else who may not be related with egg directly. And that's one of the things, is like being able to get the actual acreage to produce and then being able to keep up with that cost. Here, I hear from them that they usually need to have a certain number of animals for the operation to actually be running well and be able to get profits. So that's also something that end up kind of like excluding, not excluding, but like some people just went away because that wasn't something that they would be able to keep doing. But I think what relates with forage is probably more the cost of the land and equipment sometimes as well, that they need to be keeping up with costs. And those things combined end up just really increasing the cost of producing the feeds that they would be needing. And some people are not able to afford more newer technologies or incorporate those into the systems. So they were more limited on how much they could increase production as well. So on the large scale, you end up getting lower cost of productions, which helps on the operation.
Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together and the first ingredient in animal diets. Priority provides a more cost-effective and easier approach to nutrition. We recognize that not all bacteria are created equal. The specific strain truly matters. Priority IAC selects unique strains to provide the best performance in animals, and that's why we call these strains smart bacteria. Founded by Richard Brunig, helping to improve animal health one herd at a time.
So thinking about like the size of different operations that you have in South Carolina and, you know, what we have a variety of across the Southeast and the difficulty in getting land, how do you manage and incorporate grazing management in groups like that? Where do you focus when you're going out and talking to a dairy farm about grazing, particularly one that might be more focused on confinement?
Sure. So usually we try to focus a lot of our conversation on the two things. What would be the timing if it's year-round or just more concentrated, for example, in the cool season that they would like to have the animals having more availability to pastures. And also we need to talk about the quality that they need, because it will be high quality. We know that. And then there, here in South Carolina, so you mentioned before, I'm at the Edsel REC, which is in the southern part of the state. But depending where you are, you can use warm season grasses, or you should be just using tall fescue. So this is going to be part of the conversation as well, because between the perennial warm season grasses that we usually can use here, which is Bahia grass and Bermuda grass, for dairy systems, we're going to be focused on Bermuda grass because of the high air quality that we generally can get with hybrids. And also the production that you can get. And some producers, they may have irrigation on those pastures, which is not common for our forage producers to have because of the cost associated with having irrigation on pastures. But that's a need for their systems because of the frequency that they are going to be grazing, how much they will be relying on those areas to just turn the animals there after milking, especially. So we would be having this conversation. And like you mentioned before, we are on an area where we have mild winters. So we're very fortunate to have that because we can be overseeding Bermuda grass, Bahia grass fields with cool season annuals. And usually we do that on those systems. And we are able to combine different species. So we're combining legumes with grasses and balancing that quality as well for what they need to meet their needs there.
I don't know how many of your operations are strictly grazing or even partial grazing. It's really rare in my area. I mean, we'll have some heifers that are running on grass and maybe some dry cows, but the majority of the lactating herd for sure is still going to be under roof and in a conventional parlor. So how do we incorporate forages and forage management effectively into our confinement herds?
Here's the same thing, Liz, that you mentioned. Usually producers will be growing their silage, usually corn silage. So being able to really balance that ratio, for what they need, it's going to be something important that they are going to focus a lot of their time. And some particular one producer, a couple of operations that are close by, they will have large pasture areas dedicated more for the heifers, for example, to developing heifers, because then you can be having your calving season on a time that you're going to be able to have the cool season forages when the animals are growing, and that can be a good source for quality, but also under a lower production cost, because you're going to have high quality, usually when we're working with mixtures of cool season annuals, it's very common that we're going to have over 20% of crude protein throughout the whole time that the animals are grazing. And especially when we have ryegrass, clovers kicking in, we're going to be having 23% or more, which is like very, very high. So that's something that they would do for usually more for heifers and just to turn the animals after milking. But then for the animals that are under the barns or the feedlot areas, they will be using more silage, more the really balanced ratio that they need to meet the production that they would have. But corn silage would be a large part of that. And then most of the producers are incorporating some co-products. Some people call byproducts. We do have a lot of options around here because we have cotton production. We have some other gene trash around here. So like those things are also incorporated as part of the balancing that feed.
Do you see any value in doing things like wheatlage or grasslage or baylage and starting to incorporate that, especially for some of those operations that might be losing rental ground and are having to kind of consolidate their production due to those rising costs of renting or land being sold?
That is definitely growing. And in addition to what you mentioned about the cost, et cetera, the land cost, et cetera, one of the challenges that we definitely have here in the Southeast is the weather conditions. Right now we are very dry, and some producers keep joking with me, now is the time to be producing hay, but they don't have much growth to cut. So yeah, it's been very hard for everybody on the last almost 2 months now. But during the summer, we have a lot of producers turning to baylage, which is the product that will have over 60% of moisture to bale. And also for the cool season annuals as well, because then you can conserve that forage that's really, really high quality for a time later during summer, for example, that you would be able to just rely on adding that to the lower quality material that may be available for grazing, for example. So a lot of producers start to understand more and more that, and working with that to be able to cut costs of having to buy more of farming inputs, just rely on using the forage as a tool to balance the diet even later as well. And baylage is really something really good. It has expanded a lot. When I was in Auburn, I started working with baylage more because we were working on a alfalfa Bermuda grass project from UGA and Auburn collaborating together. And some of the producers that I was working, so this was 2020 when I first started there. Some of the producers who were our collaborators that were incorporating alfalfa into Bermuda grass fields, they started producing baylage to sell. And then maybe after 3 years, they stopped selling because they understood that they could just use that for their own animals and cut off a lot of the off-farm products that they had been buying. And that made such a huge change on the economical side for them that they kept going. And like, you know how it, in extension is neighbors see neighbors, and that's how the some of the word disseminates, spreads. So I see that also growing more and more.
Evonik is committed to help supply a growing world population with healthy and affordable animal protein while prioritizing animal welfare, the efficient use of natural resources, and food safety. Evonik's expertise in low-protein diets and supplemental amino acids help ruminant farmers around the globe to enhance feed efficiency, reduce costs, improve animal health, and lower greenhouse gas and nitrogen emissions. Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build effective and the ZDUs. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
If you're enjoying this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics, please remember to like, subscribe, and share it with your friends and family. You can also turn on notifications from our channel so you never miss an episode. please feel free to leave us a comment at any time. We want to hear from you. So kind of thinking through that farmer see, farmer do mentality that we see a lot in extension, something that I get asked a lot of questions about, and I'm sure you do too, is what kind of changes do we see from a GHG perspective in a predominantly forage or a heavy grazing system compared to some of the more conventional ones? Because that's that, it was a hot topic for a really long time, right? Like, where are we going to go with carbon credits? What does this do to methane production from our cattle? How does it shift that rumen microbe population? I know you've worked a little bit with that. So what are some insights you'd want to make sure people hear from the podcast around that?
Yes. So currently I have two projects that we're working on, and one of them we're measuring the greenhouse gases just coming from the soil. And in another, we're actually exploring what you just mentioned about the microbiome and using the green feed units to measure on the animals, the emissions on the animals. We also have another collaboration with University of Florida that we're going to be addressing the use of additives on the diet, which is one of the paths that a lot of the research has been focusing on as well. And hopefully, like later on, we plan to also have some farmer collaborators to try to use the same additive to see what response they would get. So the way that we're approaching this, for the forage systems that we're measuring from greenhouse gases from the soil, we have been focusing on different strategies for nutrient management. So common nutrient management would be just using inorganic fertilizers, nitrogen fertilizers. And then one of the sources that we have been using is poultry litter, which is also something that a lot of producers already use and just has been expanding over the past years, mostly because of the cost of the nutrient. But also some people are seeing beyond that, the other benefits that you can have as well by putting that source, organic source in the system. And then one treatment that we also use is the incorporation of legumes. So we have seen some differences on the emissions there. We just made in a paper that we like our focus for this project. It's not just doing work on the research stations. I'm also collaborating with farmers and deploying equipment on their farms, because we are trying to generate the local emissions for South Carolina, which we don't have yet, those emissions from here. So we have been seeing benefits of improving the management practices, even the grazing management, how you're rotating your animals because of the input of manure on those areas and how that's going to be distributed, etc. Manure in general, urine and manure. So we have seen some reductions of emissions in some of those different strategies compared to the inorganic nitrogen fertilizer. But also we are also measuring what we call soil health, and that involves a lot of indicators. And we also see the benefit on that side, increasing the soil health that you have on those areas. And a lot of producers here, they have been really trying to focus more and more on strategies that they can improve the soil health, because how they are thinking is that they would like the soil, sometimes the soil is not in a good condition because they bought that area somewhat recently and could not improve yet. But they're also thinking on the long term. They wanted that land to stay for their grandchildren, grandchildren later. So a lot of the conversation that I have with some farmers goes on the sense of, I want to be putting a plan that's going to be for 50 years from now, not just 5 years or those short terms that sometimes we would be looking at. So beyond the greenhouse gases, they also want to make sure that we're contributing to the sustainability, to the organic matter quality that will be on those systems as well on the long term.
So across South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, there's some vastly different soil types that you're dealing with across those states. Are you seeing similar results? Like how is it working on those super sandy Florida soils?
We actually have very similar type of soils here. South Carolina is very very interesting on that sense, like the in several sense, but in the soil side. Even on the station that we are in, the reason that Clemson bought that piece of land is because of we have all the soil types represented on that small piece of land that we have throughout the whole state almost.
That's awesome.
And it's like amazing that you're driving through a field and you can see like changing a lot. But I do work with areas where it's very, very sand, which is the sand hills. And we have some challenges there, not just from the here. We suffer a lot with drought throughout the summer. So that's a huge part of the push of my work being on resilience of systems. But we do see that we need more information, more investigation of how that needs to be adjusted based on the soil type. Because we did have, so far I was able to work with three farmers in different areas. So one of them fell more on the sandier, not as much as Florida type, but very like more sandier than the average here. And we can see how different the nutrient cycling will be. We like all the things that from the academic side we were used to talk about, to work with. And that emphasizes how much we definitely need to be exploring more for adjusting for local even conditions and edaphoclimatic conditions. Because, for example, I measure carbon accumulation as well in the same areas. And just the process that you're going to have on a place where you have more clay versus more sand is very, very different. What we can do there and the level of nutrients and what's going to actually be retained on those soils versus the other areas.
So we've talked about legumes kind of passively a lot that you're incorporating those. Are you looking more at clovers? Are there other types of legumes that you're trying to incorporate? Do you have a favorite legume?
I'm wearing purple. Just joking. So I worked a lot with Jennifer Tucker and Kim Lennox, and at some point, people are calling them and us as the alfalfa ladies, but that's the joke on the purple. But I work with a lot of the annual legumes here over the past 4 years. That's what I have been able to incorporate more. So I do work with clovers, cowpea, winter pea, all the hairy vetch, that legumes that we could use during the cool season. But I also worked with warm season legumes. So for grazing trial that we had a couple of years ago, we're about to publish that work. We use sun hemp, foraged soybeans, and cowpea in mixture with permillet and crabgrass. And I did not measure greenhouse gases there. That was just the forage production, soil health, and general quality of the forage. But we were able to see really interesting differences. I had the system that was just the grasses with the inorganic nitrogen fertilization versus the others other mixtures that were relying on the nitrogen fixation. And when you start really putting on paper the production and then you start calculating the costs, we see those differences on the price, the cost actually per ton. And that's usually what the first questions that producers will ask me when I talk about any of these studies or when they're here on the field days, how much that's going to cost for me to plant and how much that's going to cost for the whole production system, right? So when I first came here, I was just going throughout the state a lot, just talking with producers. And all of them kept asking me, prices of fertilizer were really high at the time. So they kept asking me, can you work on systems that will be low input? So low fertilizer inputs. So some of the trials that I did on the past 4 years, they were trials that I was putting like 50 units of nitrogen throughout the whole season. And that's the reason that I was focusing on the legumes and what legumes, what proportion, because that's still a question that we need to investigate a little more. What sort of proportion that you need to have? We have that general number that's around 20-22% that we try to have, because that way we avoid issues on the animals when you have legumes there. But we're also trying to investigate more and more the fixation, nitrogen fixation on those systems, and understand what's happening in terms of cycling and a lot of soil health as well. It's something that we're definitely putting more and more emphasis on as well. And that's something that really I've been working with legumes for 10 years now. So this is something that I'm really passionate about. And working with alfalfa, I'm finally able to start working with alfalfa now. We just got two projects approved here earlier this year. So I'll be working with UGA again on those projects. And we're going to be having feeding trials. We're going to be having grazing trials. It's going to be really exciting because I have a lot of producers who are growing alfalfa or are setting up to start growing alfalfa here. I've seen a push, a growing interest over the last couple of years. And it's really interesting to see how people are trying to start to incorporate more the legumes back. And understanding even that works, because I still hear, even working for 6 years with alfalfa Bermudagrass systems, I still hear that we cannot grow alfalfa in the South. And sometimes it's really funny because sometimes we're standing in the alfalfa stands, like by our tie high, and people are saying that we cannot grow alfalfa. And we go, okay, let's talk about that.
I mean, shameless plug, Bruno and I would love to be part of that with you too. So shameless plug for Tennessee, because I also hear that all the time, that we cannot grow alfalfa in Tennessee. I had one dairy farmer who's actually, you know, left the business now, that was like the alfalfa king of his county. So he grew it and grew it really well, but he was like the only one, and everyone else like, nope, can't do it. Too expensive. So yeah, love to talk more about that outside of this episode with ways that we could we can work on that.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Want a herd management software designed for you? BovaSync is helping herds by managing data faster and easier. Contact BovaSync today to learn more. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Cow Manager, ahead of the herd together.
Safe, simple, stop lack. Contact AHV for comfortable dry cow care. Reduce dyscalcemia and simplify transition cow care with Calbal Pro from Chemlock Nutrition.
We have been chatting, which is great. The time has flown by. So my last question for you before we get into those other ones that we talked about, from an extension perspective, what strategies have you found the most impactful when sharing your research and your results to inspire change in your dairy farmers?
I think, and this is going to sound very cliche, because all of us in extension saying the same thing probably. But I see, I heard this from other ones. That's the reason I'm saying that, other specialists. But I think the most impactful strategy is when they see that you care. If they understand, a lot of times, like especially now, not as much because they know me now. But when I first came in, sometimes I would go to a farm and I would spend 1 hour, 1 hour and a half just talking about life. And then after that, like it hit 1 hour on the clock, the person would turn to me and say, now let's talk about forages, because I see that you care. I see why you're here and that you're actually like concerned and invested in helping me. But I do just like thinking about the dissemination, the work that we do in research. I have a really strong emphasis on being able to disseminate research-based information, because I see how much misinformation is out there. And nowadays, we can just grab our phones and Google anything and find any information for anything that may or may not be reliable. So something that I've been really pushing forward a lot is working on written and communication. So I have a lot of guides. Some of them regional, national, that we were able to put together a really good group of collaborators from other land-grant universities to work on that. Then just general blogs, etc. But also I started the Forage Drops, which is educational channel that I'm the one developing all the videos that we have there. And that is... the type of videos that I developed there is short videos that will be addressing timely questions. For example, now I would be talking about drought. During the season, we'd be talking about what should you be scouting, what time of fertilization, etc. Just timely information for the producers to be reminded of, and just enough information for them to reach out to their extension agents, to their specialists, and some research updates as well. I've received a lot of positive feedback on using those diverse ways to disseminate information, and having able to have people seeking out more information and actually adopting changes, adopting practice through that. So the way that I see it is more like the combination of the factors.
This has been a great discussion. I cannot believe we've already been talking for 35 minutes. Does not feel like that. I do have a few questions for you. Not that I haven't asked you like 10 already before we go. So you ready for those preloaded questions? All right. So question number one, what is your favorite dairy or forage related book or resource that you would recommend?
I rely a lot on the grazing management type of guides. And honestly, and this is a forages resource. The Southern Forages is one of those books that everybody who's in extension will know about it. And just the fact that I was able to get to know Dr. Ball and Dr. Lacefield later on, and like being able to build that relationship with them, it's like one that's very emblematic to me. And Dr. Sullenberger's books as well, because that was another person that I was able to not only meet, but also be advised by.
That's really exciting. That's awesome. Outside of dairy and forages, what's your favorite book?
I am just, I like the audiobooks. I'm just listening for the third or fourth time, probably, Becoming Michelle from Michelle Obama. So I think right now I would say that. the word.
I'm with you. I don't have time to actually read, but I do love a good audiobook. There's something going on in my ear constantly.
As much as we drive, right, Liz? Like, as much as we're on the road.
Don't know what the specialist did before. I was trying to, like, balance a book on the steering wheel while they went. Sounds terrible. Okay, last question. In your opinion, what sets successful dairy or forage professionals apart from those that are less successful?
I think especially trying to have not only the background, the knowledge on different areas, but also trying to incorporate a more holistic view of the work that you're going to be doing. And nowadays, it doesn't matter if you're in academia or other areas, I think that's very important for you to build connections across the board from different areas. In academia, we are working in multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary teams. And if you're not doing that, you're probably going to struggle more with getting grants, etc. But also that approach allows you to actually look at the whole system. And that's something that I'm really passionate about it, working and thinking about. And even in extension, like I'm way more capable to help a producer when I understand all the factors and how that's going to need to be adjusted for them, for that operation. So this is something that I think that's very important for us to continue to invest time and and that's going to set you apart from others.
Absolutely. Nothing happens in a vacuum. That whole system talks to each other.
Exactly.
Well, Liliane, thank you so much for your time. This has been a great conversation, I think, anyway. A little biased because we were part of it, but, you know. So this will conclude another episode of the Dairy Podcast Show presented by Wise Genetics. Thank you all for listening to us today, and sharing it in our conversation. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes or to catch up on those that you've missed. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is invaluable to us. Until next time, this is Liz Eckelkamp from the Dairy Podcast Show, signing off. Have a dairy great day.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.